Duration. It takes about an hour. Equipment needed. 7 needles along the stomach meridian, ankles, thighs, belly, and sternum. The pathway relates to the earth element, to the center, to digestion, physical and mental. It relates to the mother, to home, to getting grounded. Place needles, open a window, and wait. Age. Same, but 36 in about a week. Relationship status. Not to be repetitive, but I'm not at my best. Cost. $65. Sliding scale if necessary. It's a generous clinic. Humiliation factor. Nada. I trust my acupuncturist and colleague Marie implicitly. Coco's advising too. Location. Longmont Alternative Healthcare Clinic, Longmont, Colorado. Possessed. Holy smoke. Marie used the word possessed. My big vacation in Colorado to de-stalkerize myself appears to involve 4 depossession treatments in a week. It doesn't feel so good to have your close friend and then 2 colleagues tell you they think you need to be depossessed. Not just once, but 4 times. Talk about the big guns. But neither does it feel good to come as close to loco as I care to touch. The first time I heard of acupuncture depossession, a.k.a. dragons, all I could picture was The Exorcist and Linda Blair's head spinning around and vomiting green. While I have seen dramatic responses to this treatment, I don't feel a need to believe one thing or another when I do it, or now having received it. Do I go home to the family holiday party and share over cocktails and olives and a fair number of anti-doctor religious relatives that I occasionally depossess people as part of my job? No, I do not. But I do perform the treatment and have witnessed unbelievable, difficult-to-explain results. The way it's diagnosed. Check in the eyes. Ever look at someone and no matter how hard you try, it's like you can't get in? Their eyes feel impenetrable? That's the look we check for in a particular close-up way. The 7 points are the acupuncturist's best shot at bringing the person back to earth, no longer absent or preoccupied. My initial experience with dragons. My friend Delia's 3-year-old son had stopped talking, virtually overnight, 6 months before she consulted me. During those months of silence, he was diagnosed with autism. I took my more conservative friends to lunch to pitch 5-element treatment. I wanted them to take him to one of my supervisors, bracing them for smelly herbs and unusual questions. I never used the P word. What am I, crazy? Based on the suddenness of her 3-year-old silence, I imagined my supervisor would do dragons. Touch, let alone needles, agitated the toddler, so the acupuncturist, who was also a neurologist, which made my friends feel better, medically sedated him to receive the needles. Because the boy was sedated with eyes closed, it was impossible to verify the treatment success by evaluating that key change in the eyes. So the practitioner put in the extra needles, 7 in each of the locations, 49 all told, to ensure that the locations had been hit properly. After the treatment, Delia took her sleeping babe home. That night, the acupuncturist neurologist dreamed that by morning, the boy awoke and crawled into Delia's lap and called her mama for the first time in 6 months. And that is exactly how it happened. And Delia? Ecstatic. And her son never stopped talking or connecting again. Now Marie, my acupuncturist, sticks those 7 special needles in me. So open that mysterious window, bring on those dragons, and bring back normal. Medic! Chapter 74. Paroxetine, a.k.a. Paxil. Purpose. Used to treat major depression, anxiety, obsessive-compulsive, and panic disorders, and social anxiety. The first antidepressant in the United States approved for panic attacks. Typically causes weight gain. Duration. 7 days. So far. Equipment needed. It comes in pill form. Age. 35.99 staring down 36. Impending spinsterdom lurking over the horizon. relationship status. Laird is coming for counseling in the Rockies. Hurry up and get normal! Employment. An acupuncturist exploring Western medication while on vacation. Cost. $100 to get on it. Sweat equity to get off it. Humiliation factor. A delayed response. Location. Coco's guest room. One of the two most comforting houses on the planet. Perfect. This is absolutely perfect. We have finally figured out why I'm having these surges of anxiety. The week's therapy, acupuncture, and dragons have done a world of good. Enough that I can separate my calm emotional state from the sudden surge of anxiety that occurs exactly 20 minutes after ingesting a Paxil. Marie, my acupuncturist, put it together. After all this, it appears I'm not actually crazy. The source of the week's insanity appears to be these big yellow pills. Every out-of-control symptom I have is listed in the physician's desk reference. I feel I must speak to the person in charge of pharmaceuticals in this country at once. Possible Paxil side effects. Anxiety, nervousness, restlessness, agitation, nausea, loss of appetite, anorexia, weight loss, talking, feeling, and acting with excitement and activity you cannot control, muscle pain or weakness, insomnia, trouble sleeping, unusual tiredness or weakness, dyspepsia, pain in the center of the chest or behind the sternum. I have all of them. Coco and I go to the appropriate websites to learn how to get off the Paxil. We learn it is considered one of the more frightening antidepressants in terms of scary withdrawal symptoms. The highlights. Muscle cramps, loss of appetite, nausea, hypersensitivity to sounds and smells, concentration problems, profuse sweating, especially at night, intense insomnia, panic attacks, even if you've never had one before, intense fear of losing your sanity, feelings of shocks pulsing through your body, slurred speech, steady feeling of existing outside reality as you know it, suicidal thoughts, extraordinarily vivid dreams / nightmares. I call my doctor. I don't know if you can call someone your doctor after seeing him once for 10 minutes, but there you go. To get advice on how to go off it. I was convinced he was an 80-year-old moron who only picked Paxil because he had a few free packages floating around in a drawer. I get no callback from him. Instead, some nurse with no expertise calls me back. So I intend to go it alone. At first I thought I would break one pill in half and step down that way, but mine are time release, and I'm concerned that if I break one in half, I'll feel the absence of the time release coating. I fear with that, the anxiety surge will be even more immediate. So I decide to go cold turkey, off the Paxil as well as the Xanax that was helping me sleep in reaction to the Paxil. I enter the guest room. At this point, I'm only mildly concerned I will spontaneously go into cardiac arrest. One of the possible side effects of withdrawal from Paxil or Xanax. I can't remember which. I crawl into bed, say goodnight to Coco, and stick my MacBook earphones in my ears and wait for Larry David to help me to sleep. I start to get drowsy, turn away from Larry David, and roll onto my stomach. I think, this can't be so bad. I'm on my belly for a few minutes, and I decide I should roll over. But what do I roll over upon but a big lump in my breast? Oh, my God. I think I just felt a lump in my breast. Wait, is that a lump in my breast? I take my little hand and get the nerve to feel around. Oh, my God. That's a lump in my breast. I am going to die. I can't believe it. I am going to die. This thing is big and round and hard. How could I have not felt this before? It might not have helped that I'd lost about 7 pounds in a week, so my breasts were simply that, breast tissue with no surrounding fat. This is why Laird is coming out for couples counseling. He is intuitively coming so he can get back together with me so that I can die of breast cancer, like his mother did. I am 36 years old, or about to turn 36, the day we meet up. His mother died at 36. I will have gone through all this hogwash with Tim and Laird only for this last guy to help me die. I, his non-girlfriend girlfriend, am in a relationship with him so he can heal from the loss of his mother, who died when he was 12. Fuck off, Freud, and take your cockamamie, female hysteria, misogyny with you. I start sweating. I am officially having a panic attack. It is unmistakable. Why did I have to find this thing 2 days before my birthday? And even more upsetting, how is it I am learning I have cancer on the one night I am trying to eliminate an anxiety-provoking drug from my system? I feel sick. I think I'm going to throw up. I decide I need to wake up Coco. It's 2 in the morning, and if I wake her, I'll also wake her husband, Ross. She is the closest, least judgmental, most resourceful person I know, so I absolutely must wake her. I feel terrible about this, but I have no choice. I am dying. I have cancer. She knows about these things. She will inspect my lump. I crawl out of bed. I'm too nauseated to walk. And into the hallway to knock on her bedroom door, still on all fours. I'm experiencing my first flop sweat. Coco can't come to the door soon enough. I'm too queasy to get up, so I wait. She comes out, finds me on the ground, and gently kneels down, placing her hand softly on my forehead the way one might delicately approach a small, injured bird. Kindness in the middle of an imbecilic meltdown. She appears alarmed that I'm so flushed with sweat. I try to look up at her as she strokes my face, but in the same breath, I'm just trying not to throw up. At the moment, I'm a pretty big fan of staying as still as possible. I summarize the situation efficiently, highlighting the most important points. I have found a lump, and it appears to be cancer. I merely need a second opinion to confirm my diagnosis. No pressure, but everything hinges on her opinion. In her gentlest, soothing voice, sweetly rubbing my brow, she whispers, "Let's get you back to bed." She helps me up and back to the bed, holding my sides, shuffling along with me in our mutual sweatpants pajamas. She retrieves a cool cloth from my forehead, kneeling next to me on the bed, wiping the washcloth in slow circles while making calming sounds. Like a deer in headlights looking up at her, I ask her to feel my breast with her other hand, not just once, but 100 times. She feels it again and again and again. I say, "Do you think it's cancer? Is that what cancer feels like? She's had lumps in her breast. Does it feel like the benign ones you've had, or does it feel different?" She says it's not cancer, but I'm too smart for this. What else do you say to a dying woman? She says the lump is mobile and that this is a positive sign. Secretly, I know she is worried because despite its mobility, it is also incredibly hard, much harder than a normal squishy cyst. We play out this nonstop breast exam till dawn. Given the previous night's discovery and shenanigans, the logical thing to do would be to go to a doctor and have my lump inspected. This would have been in keeping with my nature. I ascribe to the view that more information, good or bad, is always better than less. I prefer my bad news up front. Just rip the bandage right off instead of a slow, torturous tug. But with my current pharmacologically altered state and the upcoming couples counseling and birthday, I decide to take a revolutionary stance and embrace denial. Well, I ignore it enough to avoid a doctor's appointment, ultrasound, and a mammogram. But I continue my own personal physical exam at about 5-second intervals for the next few weeks. My version of ignoring also includes the purchase and memorization of Dr. Christiane Northrup's definitive text, Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom. I memorize the section on lumps, compulsively palpating the sucker while driving with Coco and Ross to Wyoming, where we'll meet up with Laird and celebrate my birthday with Michelle and Scott. As we drive, Coco and Ross hold hands in the front, listening and giggling to David Sedaris's Me Talk Pretty One Day. While Coco gazes out over Wyoming's sage steppe, twirling her hair and appreciating nature, I'm busy in the back, medically fondling myself. I palpate my lump thoroughly in various positions in the back seat of Coco's SUV. Lying down on my right side, lying down on my left, on my back, as well as my favorite position, looking wistfully out the window, contemplating all the things I will never do. Bear children, rock on my front porch with Laird and our grandchildren. By evening, I am preparing my eulogy and making a list of the music I would like played at my service. I stress in my notes the request to have a big campfire as well. It is my favorite smell in all the world. I also request Andrea Bocelli's classical hit, Time to Say Goodbye. I decide to not tell Laird about my lump. I don't want him to stay with my lump in me out of sympathy. I'm not sure how I would arrange his not knowing about my lump if we fool around. It would be as easy to overlook as a boulder hidden between our mattress and box spring. But I will cross that bridge later. I decide to officially worry about my cancer after the couples counseling, where I'm certain we'll end up permanently broken up. I will have plenty of time to contemplate my impending, lonely, spinster death. I don't have time for cancer. The depossession hasn't entirely rid me of my focus. I have a boyfriend to win back. Chapter 75, EMDR Resource Building Protocol. Purpose: Paxil-free in 4 days. That's roughly how long it takes to get out of the system and back to planet Earth. Instead of using EMDR to get rid of old traumas, we are using it to imprint new patterns. Duration: a few hours over more than one session. Equipment needed: the old vibrating paddles and headphones are back. Age: same damn week. Relationship status: I've let my guard down here, been held here. Magie and Coco and Marie have seen my worst, and it didn't kill me. Sometimes you have to make a sense of family to learn what family can feel like. I wish I could return the favor immediately. Cost: $80. Humiliation factor: the idea of it is embarrassing. The actual doing is not. Location: same home office of one Mr. Magic. I can eat again. I go with a nice chicken dish. That burning epigastric pain has vanished, and my joints have stopped hurting. The spinning thoughts have departed, and my sleep is deep and normal. Magie and I created a whole new protocol of EMDR to help ensure that I would not act like a stage 5 clinger, even if this nuts couples counseling retreat went badly. We're using EMDR not to revisit old traumas, but to do the opposite. We are running my brain through a rehearsal of sorts of how I'd like to behave, like an athlete coached to run through a perfect performance in her head. And somehow, the EMDR paddles and beeps act like a booster. After one particularly good session, playing out seeing Laird without my behaving like a lunatic, I leave knowing that enough anxiety has departed that I have picked the nervous callus on my thumb for the last time. With all this mental repetition, I feel like the Manchurian candidate, but in a good way? Sure enough, when I see Laird, I am calm. So calm, he asks, are you on some sort of medication? Nope, I reply serenely. Privately, I smile, knowing I'm Paxil-free. A week ago, Coco and I were in hysterics, rolling around on her living room carpet at the impossibility of my being back to myself when I saw him. But I'd done it. We'd done it. I felt calm, like I would be fine even if we didn't get back together. The only thing I hadn't gotten out of my system, my preference to win him back. Chapter 76, Post-Paxil Skinny. Purpose: this time, it's not so much purpose as an effect, but it totally counts as a modality, as weight can be used in hopes of transforming oneself. Right, wrong, good, bad, it's true. Duration: a week or so. Equipment needed: a scale. In my case, the one in Coco's bathroom. Age: officially 36. Relationship status: Limbo, lower now. Cost. Free. Emotional drama has its own charge. Humiliation factor. Split down the middle between maniacally suddenly skinny pride and utter mortification. Pride at my skinny self and atrocious mortification at said pride. Mind you, I still plan on wielding my thin body at Laird like a knife. In brand spankin' new pencil jeans, no less. Not to mention, it screams desperate, at best dogged, to convince an old boyfriend who's sleeping with someone else to do marital counseling. And watch me do it anyway. Location, Evergreen, Colorado. Skinniness has become my shield. Why have I been working so hard on incremental spiritual growth when I feel the way this unplanned plunge into skinniness makes my spirit soar? That crazy Paxil has caused massive weight loss, making me in 1 week the thinnest I've been since I was a ballet dancer on scholarship in high school. I now have six-pack abs, and my cheekbones are making a tremendous showing. Nothing like a week of burning sternal and epigastric pain and a near total inability to eat to put me one step closer to the supermodel version of myself. And I love it. I'm well aware this may be extremely screwed up, so I promise I'll look into it just after this official last-ditch Laird effort. Because other than noting my current Alice in Wonderland, drink me, shrink me self in the mirror, I'm pretty focused on the win him back thing. That said, I find this crash course back into the world of skinny makes the world, for the moment anyway, seem like an entirely kinder place. If I told you it felt otherwise, I'd be lying. Laird could leave me, Tim could shag 100 to 200 hookers, but there is no denying that my ass looks awesome. And I feel powerful. Even if I have my hands at the helm of the skinny ship and I'm steering that ship smack dab into a seawall, I feel in charge. Not to mention, in this state, I notice I give myself all sorts of nice compliments instead of circular, cruel criticism. I've watched that criticism run inside my head for ages. Thank goodness there's not a stenographer in there. It'd be a pretty boring read. But back to the win-back Laird part of this. I know that the woman, you know, that woman that Laird has started dating, I also call her Miss Live in the Now. Because I read in her Qigong teacher bio that she teaches people to live in the now. I don't, just between you and me, find her all that compelling. She goes a little heavy on the prayer beads. And anyway, the only people I know who really live in the now, let alone teach it, are 2-year-olds, a couple of monks, and an elder with Alzheimer's. But the point, Miss Live in the Now not only taught people to now it up, but to do so with a far more generous ass and a tremendous amount of beadwork. Nothing wrong with the gorgeous round ass, but somehow I only adore them on other people. And in my win-back Laird weekend, the virtual absence of my own ass shored me up. I seem to be wired, or trained, to feel so much bigger when I'm smaller. I feel emboldened by my own Alice drink-me-shrink-me-but-in-jeans routine. It isn't so much that I think Laird will find me more attractive or not. The point is that right now, weighing less, I find myself more. Bigger, stronger, more in control. Over myself, over my own internal Little Miss Nut Job. Over the sense of failure I will feel if I can't make this man love me. As if the size of my jeans can save me. As if those mean-spirited little fat cells aren't already stalking their way back to me since I went off the Paxil. Can anyone say subclinical eating disorder? Chapter 77. Passionate Marriage. Purpose. The mother load of couples counseling. This is where to go when the counselors no longer know what to do with you, and the two of you don't know what to do with the two of you. Two-on-one counseling, just you, your spouse, and either the wife or the husband of this dynamic duo, Ruth Morehouse or David Schnarch. Duration, 4 days. Equipment needed. Bring your preference, stay together, or break up, or on the fence. The passionate marriage peeps will disclose a belief in the learning that comes when couples stay together. The outcome is unpredictable, but plan on leaving with much more clarity. Age, 36 years and 6 days. Relationship status, in process. Barf, I hate the word process. Cost, it's not cheap, $3,000, and you need to travel to them and take 4 days off. Humiliation factor, I'm trying a tad too hard, don't you think? Location, Evergreen, Colorado. I am finally getting the kind of marital counseling I needed in my marriage. The fact that I'm divorced, getting marital counseling with Laird, to whom I'm not even close to marrying, let alone not even currently dating, but essentially dragging him out of Miss Live in the Now's bed, well, that seems like a wee bit of an oversight. Like getting marital counseling via proxy. A Washington Trust Bank business loan and I paid for the tuition, the dog-friendly motel, and yes, Laird's time off. Miss Live in the Now told Laird, she's buying you. You didn't buy me, Laird assured. I come here with an open heart and mind. But I thought Miss Live in the Now had a beyond fair point. Had I not made it financially burden-free, I doubt he would have come. I'd bet the tuition. But if I was going to win back his adoration, it would all come down to under-desiring him and out-differentiating her. She had no idea with what or with whom she was dealing, my pulling the differentiation card and all. Highbrow therapeutic tactics for such a lowbrow, ego-driven desire. I knew that the minute she started grasping for him, as I had, she would lose. Take that, you boyfriend snatcher! I wasn't so sure I even wanted this guy, so much as I wasn't going to lose him to some nearly cross-eyed, bad Taoist philosopher with her two-bit analysis of layers in my relationship, all the while keeping her hands and mala beads in the prayer position. Let her watch me blast right past desperate and pathetic bush dweller to caller of the romantic shots. I myself came to passionate marriage with one tiny ass and 2 tons of EMDR crammed into my brain. I felt centered. I would survive if we stayed broken up, although privately trying to quell that obsession to make this one work no matter what. But I was so successful appearing strong and clear, being differentiated and all that, not needing Laird to make me whole, blah, 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 that Laird wanted me back. Drop the mic. Turns out it's as they say. The I'll be fine without you so you are free to choose attitude suddenly made me hugely attractive. When we weren't having counseling, we sexed it up in our dog-friendly lodging. I, so mature and differentiated, rented accommodations with separate bedrooms. I, with a metric ton of work and possibly faking it till I was making it, magically appeared to be the low-desire partner. I don't mean low-desire sexually. In any couplehood, there's a high-desire and a low-desire partner. This can flip-flop. But the low-desire partner has the control. Like being willing to walk off the used car lot when negotiating. The salesman can smell it. Then suddenly, you have a deal. Are you sure you're not on something? You're so relaxed, so in yourself. In a good way. It's almost weird. Nope. I'm not on anything. Seriously. I just did some good work with Maji and got depossessed or deobsessed 4 times. According to the newly differentiated me, that was my business. I called Coco to update her. Maybe I'm using Laird to get the kind of help I wanted with Tim. Is Laird like a stand-in? Marital counseling with a stunt double? I honestly don't think he's your guy, but as long as you're there, just learn what you can. The only positive spin I can find on the merits of marital counseling with, and I mean no offense, the relational equivalent to an Oscar ceremony seat filler, is that I saw it as a testimony to my resolve to bring clarity to what the bounds of marriage are meant to be, in hopes of taking that learning into this or my next relationship, and I had done it with the person who most closely could be described as my partner. In a few months, Tim would take V to passionate marriage, per my recommendation. Maybe he got marital counseling via proxy, too. Despite one waste-of-time conversation where Laird discussed why I needed to learn to sip water out of a bottle without letting it touch my lips, most of it was productive. Although, come to think of it, maybe this was the most valuable moment. Yeah, Megan does this thing with her mouth. She looks like a trucker, he tells Ruth, our guru, like a Rocky Mountain Mrs. Claus. I tell her she should drink like they do in India. India? What's this about India? Ruth asks. In India, they know how to share water bottles elegantly, to drink from a bottle without touching their lips to it, so they can share. Laird's smoky voice making his cross-cultural bottle argument. As was often the case, his words felt more like seduction than argument. And this is a problem for you about Megan? Yes. It's an example of where she is unconscious. Ruth looks at Laird, then at me, then down to her own water bottle, sitting to her right, then back up at us. You can tell she doesn't quite know where to take the conversation from here, to the underpinnings of the relationship or the theories of how to ingest liquids internationally. I watch her look back and forth once more between us and the bottle before she makes her move. She reaches for it, looking self-conscious as we watch, while she considers whether now is the time to sip. Careful, I say, grinning. I can't help myself. All eyes are still on Ruth as she slowly untwists the cap uncomfortably and lifts the bottle to her lips. She sucks it down like a trucker, just like I do. So there. Maybe trying to differentiate, to not twist up in a man again, is like trying to quit smoking. They say the number of times you attempt to quit will eventually lead to your success. In that case, I'm one attempt closer to permanently differentiating, one more good college try at not shape-shifting for a guy. After our recoupled return to Bellingham, did Laird continue largely just to want to eat, putter, build, have sex, stuff animals, and walk the dogs? In that order? Yep. But he did pass out an extra business card or two. And did he try to hang in with committing? He tried that too. And did I try to not push so hard to make him slash us grow? Barf. Yep, I really did. I called Majid at the end of the intensive. How'd it all go? He asked. The one thing I know, Majid, I'll never again pay for marital counseling at 8% interest with a boyfriend who's broken up with me. Chapter 78. Drink ayahuasca with the União do Vegetal. Purpose. A spiritual practice based on mental concentration for self-knowledge. Michelle, ever practical, thinks I'm looking for trouble with this one. Coco gets it. Duration. About 5 hours. Associate with the UDV Church, and you can do this twice a month. Equipment needed. The tea itself, of course. A picture of Mestre Gabrielle at the front of the room. A circle of green Rubbermaid chairs. Age, 37. It's suddenly my birthday again. My, how time flies when you're kind of stuck and stumped. Relationship status. I believe Laird would like me best if I were in a permanent state of having just come out of general anesthesia. I'd like him to stumble onto some ambition. Neither of us is winning an award for acceptance. Employment. Acupuncturist, my vocation. Writing, singing lessons, studying interior design, reading about Alzheimer's, and North Cascade hiking, all avocations. Cost, free, by invitation only. Humiliation factor. Humiliation isn't the right word here. If the term were intensity factor, we'd be locked and loaded. Location, South Seattle, Washington. If you have any inkling you don't want to go the whole way, I think it's better you get up and leave right now. Because once you know, you cannot stop knowing, and you might as well get on with it. Ram Dass. Do you have the force? Do you have the light? The answer to these two questions is either yes or still waiting. Still waiting, I say in the butchered Portuguese I learned 40 minutes ago. I sit in an open session with members and guests of the União do Vegetal. Literally translated, it means Union of the Plants, a Brazilian Christian religion based on the use of Huasca, commonly known as ayahuasca, and the teachings of José Gabriel da Costa, or Mestre Gabriel, a doctrine that teaches the love of fellow humans and the practices of goodness, all in accord with the teachings of Jesus. My friend Heather invited me, as I showed interest over a year ago, when the Supreme Court upheld the UDV's right to drink their tea as a religious sacrament. A Harvard professor testified that he made it his business to educate himself on every psychoanalytic tool available and that, from his experience, ayahuasca was the single most powerful. If that's the case, I'm in. I mean, I hear the stuff can make you sick, but what's a little nausea compared to one of the single most powerful psychoanalytic, psychopharmaceutical tools one can legally take? I'm no Timothy Leary, but I'm on some sort of quest, which I share with the group in the classic sharing circle. I'm still stuck. I do most of the things one does for balance, exercise, care for clients, eat healthily, have creative outlets, etc., but inside, some places in me are stuck. Tim is getting married. Did I tell you? Not only did I find the therapy to salvage his relationship with V, but the passionate marriage duo salvaged it enough that they are to marry. What a helpful ex-wife. Full service situation. And get this. He's going to marry V using the wedding ring I gave him. You're doing what? I asked him to repeat. We're getting married, and I plan on marrying her using the ring you gave me. What about a clean slate? Didn't they want their own ring? Really? I mean... Yeah, Tim said matter-of-factly. The thing is, I bought the damn thing, and it wasn't your average guy's $100 gold band. It's platinum and gold swirls and cost $4,000. And given my recent education of Tim's tiny oversight about how much he'd spent in the prostitute department, I would have reevaluated our little divvying up of debt. So much for our do-it-yourself divorce and happy division of property, which didn't account for the 100 or so XYZs, the phone sex, the probation fees, or the waste of time dawn hours. I would have happily taken the ring back to sell on eBay. Instead, it was going to be some symbol to live on into his next marriage. Why? Why this ring? Well, I've always liked the ring. Would you consider not using it? Silence. He wouldn't have it. Maybe they liked the idea of wedding ring recycling or something. To transform it, they were going to have the ring hammered. Hammered? If I had to drink this tea to let go of the man I had married, and the laird to whom I couldn't quite commit, and who couldn't quite commit to me, well, then drink I would. The only person who could make these changes was me. Unhook from Tim's business, to let Laird go, to accept my mother's illness and my father's return to Christian Science and whole new life. He's living in Tahoe now, teaching Christian Science Sunday School, and it challenges me that he's still chasing some new business idea, this time involving tilapia fish, cold fusion, or fuel cell something or other, and organic farming in prisons. Not all together, mind you. Well, I'm not totally sure, but of equal interest, I guess. And it hooks me that at this age, I still fantasize about a dad who's more interested in Renee and me than farmed fish. Some traits, like his dream chasing, I could set my watch to. Others, like the Christian Science revival, catch me off guard. Renee, on the other hand, and unlike me, is not about to ingest ayahuasca, and instead is doing a very nice job creating a more traditional relationship with a husband and baby. She got baptized a Lutheran, joined the NRA, and practices her accuracy at the gun club. I hear they have pretty good music on the weekends. At the other end, I'm drinking some sort of psychotropic tea and bracing to vomit my brains out so I can make better choices. Go figure. If ayahuasca could help me let go of fatherly or male relationship challenges or the guilt I feel over mom, well, I'm totally, totally in. I told a group, I have certain beliefs and a certain lack of optimism that doesn't serve me. And while I know this, I can't seem to change my mind. I suspect I'm not so much stuck on a guy, I'm stuck on being stuck on guys and hold unrealistic expectations about my family, a fantasy that I must end to make room for what's real. I promise you, if there were a magic pill to take, I would take it. An incantation to say, I would say it. Perhaps it's mere stubbornness, and I need to find someone with a big enough sledgehammer to strike a titanic blow to my head. The group nodded kindly. And ayahuasca sounds the most like a sledgehammer than anything I've heard about. More nods. Letting go? You just have to do it. Like leaping out of a plane. My general relationship with it, however, mostly involved being on very good terms with its opposite, holding on. In fact, barring a workshop or violent crime that literally chopped off my hands, I wasn't so sure I could ever learn letting go. And at some point, it only makes sense that I'd try at least one church, right? To be fair or something? Okay, so the UDV isn't exactly a classic church experience, but it's as close as I can come. In the beginning, my main worry was that I wouldn't be given enough tea. I remember being handed my glass, like cloudy apple juice, and trying to lick every last drop out of it. I feared they would underestimate given my relatively small size, when really, I figured the size of the dose should be determined by the stubbornness of one's spirit. We approached the front and Mestre William for our tea, one at a time, then returned to sit in our duck-duck-goose-arranged green lawn chairs. Apparently, the Rubbermaid lounger is the chair of choice. We sipped. It was the single most disgusting ingesting experience I've ever had, like drinking rotten dead animal mixed with ammonia mashed together with the bitterness of 1,000 aspirin sprinkled with some garbage and peppered with a hint of battery acid. And then we wait. A half hour in. Nothing. Ugh, I really am too stubborn. I'm just someone it won't work on. Maybe I should ask for more. And then it comes on. A buzzing in my ears arises like a million insects on a hot Midwestern afternoon, mixed with as many model airplanes and Husqvarna chainsaws rising and falling violently inside my ears. No question this sound can be adopted immediately as a new torture device. Holy shit! I'm gonna die! Like, really! Make it go away! Make it go away! I gotta get out of here! I launch out of my green lounger, through the French doors, to the yard, and the nearest tree to commence vomiting something that looks more like brown sea foam than the can of Progresso chicken noodle soup I had for lunch. For the next 5 hours, I alternate between unabating nausea and vomiting mixed with a high-speed tour of the emotional, not the positive, underbelly of my life. Heat, buzzing, throwing up. Between retches, I kick myself for jumping in so blindly. Michelle was right to worry, but all I can do now is hang on. Experienced UDV counselors support the guests. If you feel like you're going to be sick, you're encouraged to vomit outside, so most of the guests have exploded into the yard while the haunting Portuguese prayers continue to be sung right inside the doors. One guest, all in white, shuffles in the courtyard like a fast-moving penguin in a lockdown ward with a load in his pants. At the moment, this big guy is unaccompanied, but this UDV group is organized enough that in moments, a counselor will come to his aid. I see Heather's boyfriend, Arthur, ass up, moaning in a flower bed. Arthur is a highly rational, sharp, witty tax attorney. I'm guessing this is his first bout moaning ass up in a flower bed. I myself have taken a great fondness to vomiting and rolling around in sap under a particular pine tree, the location closest to the French doors. I can't be bothered by the sappy pine needles stuck to my brown, juicy couture sweatpants. I keep trying to leave my tree, but mostly I can't move without throwing up again. Beautiful Portuguese prayers, called by Mestre William, continue to reverberate out of the session room. Guests in various positions continue to vomit in the yard. Who knew church could be like this? I still cannot move. Soon, a counselor comes to encourage me to try to come back into the room. Her name is Erin. Megan, how are you doing? Somewhere between ass up and the full fetal moaning, I reply. That's all I can say. Vomiting has kidnapped my voice box. I know they prefer you to stay in the session room, but they also don't want you vomiting in the room. I'm torn, as I want to do it right. Even feeling I'm about to die, I want to follow the rules. I'm so sorry, so sorry, so sorry, I eke out. Erin lightly rubs my back, reminding me of her presence when I can't look up, which is most of the time. She stays beside me for hours. Somehow I end up on the other side of the yard. I guess I crawled or rolled there. I'm not sure. No recall whatsoever. Erin offers me a rubber band so I'll stop puking on my hair. How long has it been? I ask. You're about 2 hours in, about three to go. Oh, God. I try moaning to see if it helps. Then a new position, a curled up roly-poly. My life and a whole string of sense memories rumble through like a train with a decided course. And not the good sense memories, the ones that remind me of the ways I grew smaller, not bigger. You're doing fine, Erin says. This woman is a saint. I know Erin is battling stage 4 cancer, and even with all that, she chose to spend her Sunday this way to help people like me. Imagine what it would be like to completely fall apart, like completely, to be irrationally, vomitously, unpopularly, emotionally overextended so extensively that you can't be polite or together or conscientious or insightful, and that then this person, this stranger, seeing all that, comes to your aid. I was exactly all those things, and Erin never left me. Meanwhile, the Clockwork Orange version of my life keeps barreling through me. You know that part where they put toothpicks under his eyelids or something so he can't not look at whatever he doesn't want to look at? It's like that. Because of Erin, I experienced far more than a chemical brain experiment. I will be in love with her for the rest of my life. If I had to get that sick to experience such patience and kindness, I'm the better for it. Kind women to help me out of the holes I take myself down with undependable men. I'm starting to notice this. Erin has to help another guest. I hear her say to another counselor, Arthur's stuck on the toilet. Can you help me get him off? Tax attorney Arthur, stuck on the toilet. After the apparent toilet triage, Counselor Darren returns and sits down next to me in the grass. Do you know what this experience is about for you? He asks. It's important to not just let this blast you, but understand it for yourself as much as you can. I nod. I do understand. Another hour passes, largely in Darren's company. Enormous, kind brown eyes above me as I continue on my runaway train. Erin returns to ask, Mestre William would like to know if you could return to the group. Can you walk with me? Erin and I take the world's slowest walk back to the room. I walk hunched with my hands on my knees. For all I know, it took half an hour to walk what would normally take 10 seconds. After 5 hours and a now gradual return to Earth, I hear singer Israel Kamaka Viva Ole's Hawaiian version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow in the background. Mestre William asks us how it was. The appropriate answer is, Fue boa, gracias a Deus. Well, thanks to God. But upon sitting up to say this, I have to vomit again and run to the yard. So my reply from the pine tree is, "Fouet, wretch, blah!" Well, I can't get that last thanks to God bit out before I have to heave again. Gracias, wretch, adeus. Then William asks us to share our experiences. A heavy-set guy with a gray ponytail, rock band t-shirt, and rings on every finger goes first. During my session, I called and met with all my angel guides and communed with them. I can tell he is one of the spiritual experts, guaranteed to rub me the wrong way. He appears to talk mostly to make sure we know about his previous trainings that allow him to call in his various forces and gods. It's all about us dancing together. My gods danced with me. I chose to engage them, interact with them. I couldn't fathom how someone could drink this and still have any sense of identity, authority, not to mention dancing ability. Maybe they hadn't given this guy enough tea. I myself had just tried to hold on for dear life while feeling head to toe blown apart. So what did it do to me? First, I've come to realize that it's virtually impossible to talk about any experience all that successfully when there is an urge to use the term life-changing. Largely because almost any person who would hear that, including me, tends to think you're a chucklehead, bought the snake oil, drank the Kool-Aid, or D, all of the above. Look, if having a completely normal life, maybe I had a boat, or was a big skier, or loved to watch movies, or enjoyed having a beer with my buddies on the weekend while holding down a regular job or had 2.1 kids and a dog, would have sustained me, believe me, I would have done it. It sounds lovely, really, but my ticket didn't get punched that way. Instead, I find myself spending my birthday vomiting my brains out. But what does the ayahuasca do? My theory? It's not one thing, but a combination of many. The tea is brewed for days in the Brazilian rainforest, highly ritualized, surrounded by people supporting the community and its making. When the tea is drunk, it's done in an intimate, safe setting. Nothing casual about it. The session director, trained to sense what people need, selects the prayers called particularly for that group. And the overwhelming message of the calls and the music and the prayers? Hold on, people. It might sound corny, but I have to say it. The message? Love. Unadulterated, unconditional love directed to the goodness and the force and the light of each person. I have drunk the tea a few times since, and this is what I've figured out so far. It isn't the tea itself that unsettles me. It's the power and intention of the group in combination with the tea. In subsequent sessions, every time I would leave the circle to vomit, I knew if I sat and waited the session out in the bathroom, I could ride it out no problem. But to re-enter the circle of participants with the music and the emotion rising like a cathedral, accompanied by this feeling of love in the room, that's what seemed to make me sick. As if my system had been trained to not take in too much love or a strong belief in my own goodness for fear I wouldn't be enough. It wouldn't be enough. But the power of the tea is that it forces my nervous system to receive more, more of what is actually here. A group of people gathered to wish one another well, and find communion with themselves and that unexplainable sense of something larger. And lo and behold, each time I left the circle to barf, I would feel a smidge more like my normal, less drippingly positive self, and this would make me feel less sick. And each time I would re-enter the circle, I would feel the calls pulsate my body to the point of uncontrollable nausea. I would try to sit as long as I could to take in this kindness I could feel, up until the point of retching, waiting till I couldn't bear it another minute, and then would set my mind to bear it a minute more. When it got too much, off I would go to the bathroom or to the little plastic-lined trash cans dotting the entryway. but I would eventually return to the group, taking in tiny bites of kindness one at a time. Now, don't get me wrong. It's not that no one had shown me kindness in my life. Far from it. It's that there seemed to be resistance in me or a lack of recognition to know how much I could receive. And the new information I could take in was that there was love here for no other reason than my being exactly as I was. Ayahuasca felt like strong enough medicine for someone like me, as if the tea said, I don't care what sort of fight you put up, you are going to take this in. Like I got force-fed some really good food, and I screamed and yelled and barfed my way through my first meal. But then suddenly, I could taste. Sometimes it's after you start eating that you realize how hungry you are. After that first session, Heather drove Arthur and me home. While we were all together, a storm had passed through Bellingham, and my favorite tree now lay fallen in my yard, split open right down the middle. I stepped over that tree and walked inside. I knew that Laird would be leaving, and I knew I needed to go too.